Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, the media seemed to get what they wanted from Tuesday night's town hall debate. Here's a sampling of a few of the Wednesday morning headlines. The Wall Street Journal, candidates tangle in fractious debate. The New York Times, Obama and Romney mount biting attacks in debate rematch. The Seattle Times, this time neither one pulls his punches, and the Dallas Morning News, gloves come off. So what did you make of coverage of the second debate that took place this week? Where would you put the focus, on the boxing gloves or on the content? This Monday will be the third and final presidential debate with a focus on foreign policy. So far, Libya and Iran have dominated the foreign policy questions. What else will be discussed? Will we get a question about drones, for example? Joining us to talk about coverage is Jonathan Steele, a columnist and roving foreign correspondent for The Guardian. His new book is called Ghosts of Afghanistan. Since 9/11, Jonathan has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, and Syria. And Jonathan joins us from London. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Nice to have you back. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He writes the No Comment blog for Harper's.com. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And a little later in the show, we will talk about the environmental questions and the oil drilling questions with Mother Jones' Kate Shepard. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Scott, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'll give you two things. First of all, I really love the Newsweek cover story this week by Sidney Blumenthal that's called Lincoln the Campaigner. And it, you know, in a time when you think we're completely exhausted with Abraham Lincoln stories, we have two movies out right now, or one about to come out. Sidney Blumenthal gives us a quite different take tuned to the election season, in which he tells us that far from being a person who is above it all, Abraham Lincoln was a nitty-gritty political figure who was very, very adept at campaigning. And secondly, I would pick Greg Miller's story in the Washington Post about the CIA and its request for more drones, another very important step in the transformation of the CIA from intelligence service to paramilitary force. I think one of the important changes that's occurred in the course of the last decade that's not getting really any material discussion in the political sector.
And what are they requesting exactly?
They're requesting to expand their fleet of drones, and they're justifying that with the suggestion that they will need to use them to launch attacks throughout the Middle East and North Africa. So an expansion of their paramilitary role.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because later in the show, I'd like to ask you and Jonathan about the lack of discussion about drones in this campaign. So kudos to the Washington Post and kudos to Newsweek. Oh, and also we got news this week that Newsweek's print edition is saying goodbye.
And sad news.
Sad news. And, you know, Scott, I just resubscribed to Harper's Magazine, and I was just kind of curious to find out a little bit about the future of Harper's Magazine.
Well, we have a publisher who's determined to continue to print and believes in print and doesn't believe in electronic media, but I'd say most of his staff has a different view. So I think we're seeing changes that are almost inevitable, and a readership that's much more focused on reading things online. So pretty much everyone's adopting to it, and I assume Harper's is going to be in that same group at some point.
Would you think that we'll have a magazine, though, for the next few years, hopefully?
I have no doubt that for the next several years there will be print magazines for libraries and things of that sort. But I think if we look at the readership over time and how the readers are viewing the magazine, I think we're going to see year on year a decline in the number of readers who are looking at a pulp paper version of the publication, and a rise of those who are reading the publication through electronic media.
All right. Well, thank you for the kudos. And I should say that for $12, it's a very good deal to subscribe to Harper's Magazine.
You bet.
Yeah. All right. And Jonathan, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I always feel a bit embarrassed if I pick a story from The Guardian.
Please don't.
Do one, because it's also an offbeat thing, an issue that's hardly ever discussed. It was a story revealing that in Saudi Arabia, the headline was Secret Cinema Group Challenges Saudi Puritanism. Saudi Arabia is one of the only countries in the world that has no public cinemas at all. And yet they had a group of filmmakers in Saudi Arabia who didn't want to give their names, actually launched a secret cinema group last week. And they had to show it in a sort of rented hall, almost like a garage. There was no screen. They just used a white sheet hanging on the wall. But they showed some documentaries about the fate or plight of migrant workers on construction sites in Saudi Arabia, and another one on women's rights. Mm. And it happened to coincide with what's going on here in London, which is the London Film Festival, this wonderful Saudi film that I went to see that, you know, your listeners should really try and get hold of through YouTube. It's called Wajda, spelled W-A-D-J-D-A, if you do a web search on that. Fantastic Saudi filmmaker. She's a woman, and she's the first woman to make a film. She actually did shoot it in Saudi Arabia, but she had to be inside a van. She couldn't be on the street directing the actors. She had to be doing it through with a mobile phone and walkie-talkie from inside a van as she looked out of the window.
What is the film about?
Well, it's a terrific film about a small family with a girl who wants to have a bicycle. She's about 9 years old, but girls are not allowed to ride bicycles. And but the film is not just about children. It's about adults, and it's about not just about the suppression of women as such. It's about the incredible repressed sexuality in Saudi society. And, you know, the mother says to her daughter when she sees her riding a bike that a small boy in her neighborhood has lent her briefly, she says, "You'll lose your virginity if you ride that bicycle." Mm.
Wow. Well, I'd love to read that article, and please don't be embarrassed for giving kudos to your colleagues, because you all do great work. And I just have to ask you, Jonathan, quickly, are the authorities cracking down? Are they trying to find these filmmakers?
No, the film director who made this film, Wajda, who's called Haifa Al-Mansour, was in London for the first showing of the film. And she was quite diplomatic, saying that there are signs of a kind of liberalization. The very fact that she was able to produce this film, she was given permission to produce it. She didn't tell them the exact subject matter, but they allowed her to produce it, even though, as I say, she couldn't appear in public as a director and had to do it from inside this van. So she was seeing that as a small sign of progress. Mm. But I think she was being diplomatic rather than, one should take absolutely 100%, the real advance that constitutes.
Right. Well, thank you for those. And we will put links to the documentary as well as the article, the Guardian article about the Saudi Film Festival, the Underground Film Festival, at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about media coverage of the second presidential debate, which took place on Tuesday. And Jonathan, how is this playing out in the UK? How significant is this election for Britain? Because last time, Europeans were just jubilant when President Obama was elected. What does it look like this time around in the media?
Well, there's obviously a considerable amount of disappointment over Obama's record, particularly on foreign policy, because that's what people mainly look at abroad. But nevertheless, I think there's a clear hope, certainly in Britain, and I think on the continent as well, that Obama gets re-elected. I think people are worried that Romney will be kind of George W. Bush redux, Mark II. They're really quite worried by his lack of understanding of foreign affairs, the gaffe he made when he came to London during the London Olympics. And so people were really concerned after the first debate that Obama seemed to be throwing it away.
And what, in terms of foreign policy, what issues are getting the most attention in the UK press?
Well, the big issues obviously are still Afghanistan and Syria. Those are the big issues. I mean, we are dominated by the Eurozone crisis, but that doesn't really affect the United States. So we're not looking to the Americans to do anything on that front. But apart from the Eurozone crisis, as I say, I think it's Afghanistan and Syria are the big issues. And now there's some interest in the whole issue of Burma and the developing Burmese-U.S. relationship and what that does to China.
And you have reported from many of these countries, and I just wanted to get your comment on the car bombing in Beirut that we're hearing about here on the West Coast this morning. At least 8 people died, 78 injured in central Beirut. What is your read of this, and what does this say for the region overall?
Well, I mean, Lebanon is the country that is most affected by potential spillover from the crisis in Syria, because it obviously has Sunni-Shia tensions. It has had its own civil war, and although that is now 15 years in the past, it's still quite a tense situation there, and quite fragile. And this seems to be, whoever did it is obviously trying to send a message that those who support the Syrian opposition should look out, and they can't expect a complete safe haven. So it is clearly linked it seems to be a strong indication that it's linked to the Syrian crisis.
And Scott, do you have anything to add on the news that we're getting this morning?
No, I mean, I think Jonathan has that just right. I mean, I think you'd have to view what's going on in Lebanon, although it's still early to have any meaningful assessment. You'd have to view it in the context of what's going on next door in Syria. And you'd have to be concerned about, you know, what will be the outcome for the region of the deterioration of the Assad regime. Because I think we hear, you know, in the U.S. media, we hear the usual neoconservative cheerleading for intervention and supporting the rebels. But of course, the big question is, who are these rebels that they're talking about supporting? I mean, we have many, many different groups together, and I would say certainly some of those groups are likely new enemies for the neocons. So there's certainly no clean solution and no easy prescription for the Western alliance becoming involved there. But increasingly, you know, this will be a big issue for NATO, no doubt, particularly because of the forward role that Turkey is already playing in that conflict. So if anything, this should be a bigger issue in the American presidential debate than it is right now.
Yeah, and Jonathan, like Scott says, it's really not an issue in the presidential debates. Libya is dominating. You were in Syria a couple of months ago reporting that the situation is getting worse by the day. What do we need to know about what's happening there today, and does The Guardian have any correspondence there?
We don't have anybody at the moment in Syria. We had a great difficulty getting visas, like most Western papers. So we've had people going in with the rebels a number of times in and around Aleppo, and earlier when Homs was the central issue. I did, as you say, manage to get a visa briefly for Damascus in August. I mean, I think the situation is going rapidly downhill, and I was very encouraged that Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, who on the whole normally takes the US line, broke from it just a week or so ago by calling for not only a ceasefire, but an arms embargo now on rebel forces, on arms going to the rebels as well as to the government. So he's clearly beginning to see that this is a war that it could be endless, that there's no military victory for the rebels in sight, and there will be no military victory for the government either. It is just a war of attrition, and the responsible thing now for the outside world is not to pump more arms in, but to call for a ceasefire and an arms embargo and some kind of political process that will involve negotiations either through the UN Arab envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, who's doing his best at the moment, or through some other mechanism. But the military solution ought to be put to bed for the moment.
That is Jonathan Steele, a columnist and roving foreign correspondent for The Guardian. His new book is Ghosts of Afghanistan. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He writes the No Comment blog for Harper's.com. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on media coverage of Tuesday night's town hall? What about media coverage of U.S. foreign policy? Monday night's debate will be the third and final presidential debate with a focus specifically on U.S. foreign policy. So what questions do you think need to be asked? What is not being discussed that you would like to hear about? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Scott, what are your thoughts about Libya really dominating the questions? I understand that you had a conversation with a Republican consultant about this very issue just a couple of weeks ago.
I did, and I was told, and he told me, look, we see an opening with this issue. We are going to turn Libya into an issue. It's our opportunity to seize the high ground on national security issues, which has traditionally been viewed as Republican turf. And we'll use it to embarrass the administration and score points. And I was very skeptical that they'd be able to do it. I mean, my immediate reaction was, well, you know, how do issues about security at a consulate land on the desk of the President of the United States? They don't. But I have to say, my Republican friend was right. I mean, they have succeeded in spinning this issue and giving it a great deal of prominence. And I think this is a great example of how our presidential campaigns distort foreign policy issues. I think there's a huge question surrounding the adequacy of intelligence that the U.S. is producing about the Middle East. Generally, we have a CIA that gets $80 billion a year, roughly, and that has done an absolutely abysmal job. I mean, they didn't see the Arab Spring coming. They have misanalyzed what's going on in Syria largely. There are a whole series of things they've missed, including Libya, for instance. But that's not the issue. I mean, the issue has been the robust nature of the administration and its proactiveness in protecting American personnel, and I think that's getting far afield from real concerns. The only problem they suffered was that Mitt Romney, trying to push this in the second presidential debate, botched it classically, because instead of focusing on their core issue, which was security and diplomatic personnel, he allowed his remarks to turn on specific words, act of terror, where it turns out he was simply misinformed, because the president had used those words. So I think that blew up in his face for a moment.
Well, we've got a number of callers on this, so let's hear from Ed in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I think the most important question we should put to President Obama is based on what he's promised many, many times. He said it over and over again when he was running in 2008. He said, I want to not only get us out of Iraq, I want to change the mindset that got us into Iraq. I think we should ask him, well, what have you done so far to help change that mindset that got us into Iraq? And how can we define that mindset that got us into Iraq? If we could define it very broadly, and I think we should, we could reverse the entire drive toward of militarism in this country. The mindset that got us into Iraq is the same mindset that got us into Vietnam and all the other troubles around the world. We think force and domination is the way to go. That's the mindset. That's what we need to change.
Well, Jonathan, what are your thoughts on this? You've reported from Iraq.
Well, I mean, although President Obama did get the troops out of Iraq, he was hoping to keep a residual presence in there, and it was only because they couldn't agree on the terms of immunity for U.S. service people in Iraq that the talks broke down, and they finally agreed there would be no troops. But the same thing is being repeated in Afghanistan, and your caller is absolutely right. I think one of the unspoken issues in this U.S. presidential election is the fact that both candidates seem to want to keep troops in Afghanistan after 2014. There's a kind of almost a confidence trick being played on the American people that the U.S. troops are leaving Afghanistan. They're not. They want to keep something like 15, 20,000 troops after 2014. They'll be called trainers, but they'll still be in uniform, they'll still be armed, and they'll still be targets for the car bombs and the suicide attacks, and people will be killed. And so the intervention is not ending in 2014.
So, Jonathan, how would you assess a U.S. foreign policy overall and the last 4 years under the Obama administration? What would you ask at a debate?
Well, I would ask, what are the, have you changed the parameters under which the U.S. intervenes in foreign countries? Have you moved to a different policy where you don't intervene militarily, but you use your political and economic and cultural influences to express American values abroad rather than through military intervention? And I don't see any real change under Obama in that at all. I think this kind of interventionism and the need for U.S. bases abroad and troops abroad and to come in and prop up governments or topple governments is still very dominant in the Pentagon. I mean, I think the trouble is that U.S.-Afghan policy is made in the Pentagon and not the White House, and the president doesn't seem to be able to stand up to the generals, and to including the former general who ran Afghanistan and now heads the CIA, David Petraeus.
What about you, Scott? What would you add to that?
I think that question was asked, actually, during the vice presidential debate, and we got absolutely meaningless answers. Neither of the candidates gave a clear series of criteria for foreign interventions, and it is a vital question. But I would say that there has been some shift from the Bush administration to the Obama administration, not as much as most people would have expected by looking at Obama's rhetoric. But if you look at the handling of Libya, for instance, I mean, this is a case where actually the generals in the Pentagon counseled very strongly against any kind of intervention. And there was, nevertheless, a U.S. commitment, and that was as a result largely of the advocacy of people on Obama's staff and the State Department, as best I can see. But there, I think, we saw a different Obama administration strategy towards intervention, which was no troops on the ground, basically leading from behind, as he says, using British and French forces up front, supporting local forces on the ground, but basically not having an American footprint there at all. So that seems to be a difference from the massive troop commitment, massive bombardment approach that we saw from the Republicans, and I think people like Senator McCain were arguing for Libya. So there has been some shift, but, you know, we really don't see much of a satisfying articulation of policy in the debates, even when the questions are presented. But I'd also come back and say that Jonathan's absolutely right about Afghanistan. I mean, on the drawdown, you know, if public opinion polling shows between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans want us out, and when they go into the voting booth, they won't have that option. And this, I think, is a very disturbing phenomenon, showing how national security issues have been withdrawn from the political shelf so that the public really has no say about them.
Well, let's take one more caller before break. Let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Hi, thank you. I just wonder, do people think that president is a dictator where he can do anything he wants? With the Congress that he's dealt with, there is not much he can do, no matter how good intention he may be. So what American people should do is get vote the Tea Party nuts out of office if you want the president to do what he promised to do. Only a dictator can do what they promised to do 100% of the time.
All right, well, we'll get a response, Alex. You believe his hands are tied by Congress, which we hear from a lot of people. And we'll get a response right after the break from Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, and Jonathan Steele, a columnist and roving foreign correspondent for The Guardian. And it's our weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We're talking about coverage of Tuesday's debate. We're talking about foreign policy. Monday is the last debate, specifically focusing on foreign policy. What questions do you hope will be asked? What is missing from the foreign policy debate? It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up on Monday, we will speak with three winners of this year's David Brower Youth Awards, which honors young people for their achievements in environmental and social justice advocacy. Do you know a young person who's inspired you to do more to protect the environment? Tuesday night will be the David Brower Youth Awards. It's free. It's a great event. You can find more information online. And then on Tuesday, the day after the last presidential debate, which focuses on foreign policy, we will open up the lines to get your reaction to the last debate. So be sure to watch it and then call in on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're just weeks away from the election. Don't forget, for the first time in California, you can register to vote online at the Secretary of State's website. So be sure to pass that around to your friends and family. Today, it's our weekly media roundtable, and we're joined by Jonathan Steele, columnist and roving foreign correspondent with The Guardian. His new book is Ghosts of Afghanistan. He has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, and Syria. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, which is still in print, hopefully will be for a long time. He writes the No Comment blog for Harper's.com. And Scott, what are your thoughts on Alex's comment? We hear this a lot from a lot of Obama supporters, that his hands are tied by Congress. This is another reason why he couldn't close Guantanamo, for example. What are your thoughts on that argument?
Well, that's the perfect example of it. I mean, you know, and in fact, Obama recently, in the interview he gave with to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, he talked about that a little bit. And I think he's right. I mean, Congress does have the power, if it wishes to intervene and tie his hands. And Congress decided to frustrate his policies on Guantanamo and was very effective in doing it. In fact, it was congressional leaders who, throughout the Bush administration, continuously said Congress should step to the side and let the president handle this, who, when Obama came in, decided, no, Congress was going to dictate all the parameters. So that's true to an extent. On the other hand, you have to say that that the division of powers between Congress and the president on national security issues and foreign policy is not exactly even. There's a role for Congress, but it's more in terms of the formulation of policy and more of a long-term role, whereas the immediate power and ability to act rests with the president. So he's really the person on the front line, which is a reason why it is a particularly suitable topic for presidential debates.
And Jonathan, in terms of policies and how they get pushed through or not, how does that get covered in the UK press? Do you hear much about Congress and the president's hands being tied?
I think most people are not as well informed as that. They think the president has pretty much total control over foreign policy, and so they're often quite surprised to hear that Congress has frustrated the president in doing something or other on the foreign affairs field. But, the Congress can deal with the financial side of it and cut aid and so on, or demand more aid. But on a lot of things, the president clearly has the overriding thing, like on these drone attacks that you mentioned at the beginning. I mean, we hear that President Obama has a sort of, I'm not sure what the word is, a death list or target list or something, which he goes through virtually every morning in the Oval Office, of people who could be legitimate targets of drone attacks. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the amount of hands-on day-to-day coverage of these war issues the president does put in.
Yeah, and Jonathan, I'm glad you brought up drones, because Glenn Greenwald, who used to be a columnist for Salon, is now working for your paper. I understand he wanted a more global audience. Now, he consistently writes about drones, but he's one of the only ones that has that kind of platform that consistently writes about this. And according to a Bureau of Investigation, drones have killed more than 2,500 people in Pakistan since 2004, more than 350 in Yemen since 2002, more than 50 in Somalia since 2007. This is not getting much attention at all during this campaign. What are your thoughts on that, and does this get much attention in the UK?
No, well, it is getting more and more attention because of these stories that touched on the point I just made, that the president is taking a real hands-on interest in this whole thing. And it is macabre, really. You know, we have British military people ourselves in Nevada. At, I think, is it Ellis Air Force Base or whatever, Nellis Air Force Base, we're handling these drones and setting up these screens and targeting and so on, jointly with the U.S. Military people. So it's quite a big issue here, and it is, of course, incredible the way the war on terror has escalated since 9/11 and into turning into what Donald Rumsfeld called a long war. It just seems to be endless.
It's Nellis in Las Vegas. So is there a healthy debate, at least, in the U.K. about these drones and what, you know, what they're doing and where this is going in the future?
Yeah, no. People see that as the new face of war in the 21st century. That it's an extension of this so-called force protection thing, whereby you try and minimize casualties on your own side to zero. And this is a way of doing it. You know, it's not even doing it by planes like it was in Vietnam and B-52 bombers flying above the clouds and not seeing where their bombs were landing. This is even more grotesquely remote, and yet it's lethal.
We have an email from a listener who says, your guest, Jonathan, said that the UK, Europe in general, wants the president to be elected, although they're disappointed in him, given that he hasn't lived up to his Nobel Peace Prize, drones, hasn't closed Gitmo, his saber rattling against Iran for Israel, the unequivocal support of what Israel does, minus some occasional verbal window dressing. What difference in U.S. foreign policy, including military policy, does Europe expect from Obama that they don't expect from Romney?
Well, I think it is the point that I made, that people think Romney will be another George W. Bush, and they're really worried that it could be even worse under Obama. So it's not that they think by re-electing Obama there will be a major change for the better in foreign policy as the U.S. leads it, but that it could be considerably worse if Romney got there. There'd be more interventionism and more use of drones and just generally a much more hardline John McCain style, getting tough with everybody. And Iran, of course, is a big issue which we haven't yet discussed on this program. I think there's more of a feeling that Romney would support Netanyahu in some kind of military strike on Iran, whereas Obama would be perhaps a little bit more cautious.
Well, we have a related caller. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning, Rose, and thank you very much for taking my call. While President Obama's foreign policy is very unsatisfactory to the people that are against these foreign involvements that we're in, it seems that Mr. McGovern or Mr. Romney is actually scary. He talks about expanding the military. What reason? Nobody ever asks him why he's doing that, because all the lead countries in Europe, Germany, France, England, have all reduced their military. I think the German armed forces today is down to 165,000 standing men and women. It used to be 250,000. I mean, the countries in Europe are just cutting their military way back, and he's talking about way expanding it.
Yeah, and President Obama also often repeats that. Scott, what are your thoughts on that and how the media are not dealing with an explanation of this?
Yeah, well, I think, there are two important aspects of it. I mean, the first is it plays into the overall budget questions, where Romney's constantly promising that he's going to have a thriftier budget, bring down the deficit and so forth. And yet we see proposals for very dramatic spending increase with no explanation of where the money's going to come from for all of that. And I think there's no better example of this than with defense budget. But the other side is, what's the underlying assumption of the increased budget? The military right now gets every penny it wants from the Obama administration. And in fact, if you talk to senior people in the military, they say, no, they actually would like to see more money spent on things like diplomacy with the State Department, which have immediate implications for the military and military operations, and which are running in a threadbare way right now. But I think what underlies the Romney premise is more wars, and pursuing them with aggressive military action. So much like the Bush years. And that, I think, is a very, very big issue.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, John. Thank you for the email. And Jonathan, thank you for staying longer than expected. Before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm making another trip to Afghanistan, actually, in a couple of weeks' time. I'll be back in Kabul just after the U.S. election to see what the fallout of that is and what ordinary Afghans think about the impending drawdown. I'm not going to say withdrawal of U.S. forces.
Well, we'd love to have you on, maybe even when you're in Kabul.
Okay, well, with pleasure.
Okay, thank you so much, Jonathan. Have a good night. That's Jonathan Steele. He is a columnist and roving correspondent for The Guardian. His new book is Ghosts of Afghanistan. He was in Syria about a month ago, and you can find a link to his work at yourcallradio.org. And staying around with us for the rest of the hour is Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He writes the No Comment blog for harpers.com. And if you'd like to weigh in, we've got one line open. We're talking about media coverage of the debates on Tuesday, the upcoming last debate, which will focus on foreign policy on Monday night. What do you think has been missing from media coverage of foreign policy? What would you like asked? And if there was a story you saw this week that you thought was done well or something that just deserved more coverage, did you see that the Green Party candidates got arrested trying to get into the debates? Who covered that? If there was a story that you just would like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Rose. So I've actually taught and coached debate at the collegiate level for over 10 years, and we picked apart this last debate in my argumentation and debate class, and one of my students likened it to watching two roosters square off in a barnyard. And what we got to talking about was, why has there not been more media scrutiny on the actual coaches and consultants that are being used to prep the candidates for these debates?
And what do you think we would get out of that?
I think a couple of things. I think one, if there was more scrutiny and digging in a little bit, I would say that there was, for example, maybe some deliberate coaching on this notion of getting in each other's physical space, which we saw a lot happening. Matter of fact, I'd be very surprised if we were to ever see that format again, because I actually had my class watch it without sound, just to watch the physicality. Huh. And if you watch it without sound, it really is almost bizarre to watch these two professional legislators that have been doing this for a long time, whether in the corporate realm or government realm, have that sort of violation of physical space in a debate. And so I don't think that it might be something that's natural to either one of them. I really want to know what's going on behind the scenes with these debate coaches, that they're paying a lot of money to supposedly give them an edge in these debates.
And how old are your students? Or what grade are
these?
They?
These are college students.
They're
college students. Uh-huh.
Interesting. So were they turned off by it?
Yeah. And I have sort of a mix of students who identify as Republican, Democrat, and the general consensus, especially after what they've been learning from me, is, you know what, they violate a lot of good basic concepts of delivery, and actually the message gets lost.
Okay, and what about the message? What did they think of the content itself?
They didn't think that either candidate really got into a lot of substance, and to them that actually heightened the ability of the physicality that was taking place and some of the poor delivery in terms of taking away from what really the debate should be about, which I believe and my students are passionate about. They want to be educated, right? Like, even if they have a leaning, they want to know more about issues, and they feel that, especially this last debate, that it was anything but that.
Well, thank you. We're getting a lot of emails that are saying the same things about lack of substance. Scott, what are your thoughts on the role the media should play in letting the public know about what goes on behind the scenes?
Well, I think there are a lot there. That this is a fascinating question, and I think there are a lot of big issues. I mean, one of them is that we know these debates are, the formats are proposed by the Presidential Commission, but then there's a negotiation that goes on with each of the campaigns, and there's a confidential agreement that's worked out with them. And just before this last debate, we actually had a leak that occurred of this confidential agreement. And I think if we look at the way the debate actually went off against this this meticulously worked out agreement of what was supposed to happen, the most amazing thing was they didn't care about the rules. You know, they specified very particular rules about where they could stand, where they could walk around, whether they could pose questions to one another, and the consequences. And it seems like from the first few minutes of the debate, the candidates, both candidates actually, disregarded the rules that had been negotiated and agreed upon. And that was remarkable. I actually thought that on substance, we rarely actually get deep in a policy way into substance in presidential debates. We only skim the tops of the waves. I actually thought this last debate was something that kept you on the edge of your seats. It was exciting. It was challenging. George Will said, you know, he'd been watching debates since Nixon and Kennedy, and he thought this was the best presidential debate ever. And I agree with your caller that, you know, if you were grading this on the basis of formal collegiate debating style, it wasn't very satisfactory. There was too much violation of fundamental rules, but I thought it was something actually very entertaining to watch.
Well, so, and Newsweek broke that story, and Democracy Now! has done a really good job of looking at just how staged this thing is. But don't you think part of the reason why this happened is because, you know, the media slammed President Obama during the first debate for being, quote, you know, too nice? And again, I mean, I look, these adjectives that they used the morning after, I mean, they loved it, obviously. Candidates tangle, biting attacks, they pull punches, their gloves come off. I mean, the media, they love this stuff, right?
That's right. But I think there's no getting around the fact that Barack Obama's performance in the first debate was abysmal. It was so lackluster, so boring. And I think Mitt Romney's performance was pretty consistent across all the debates. You know, I mean, it was, in a formal sense, pretty good, but, you know, he made some mistakes, some unforced errors. Obama's fluctuated wildly between the first and the second debate. I mean, I thought the second debate, it bordered on being brilliant. But in any event, I thought, you know, it made for entertaining watching, even for low-information voters.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call. And it's great that you're having these dialogues in your college classes. Thanks again for calling, Jason. And you can join us, 866. Actually, we've got full lines. Now would be a really great time to post your comment on our website. And I'll be sure to look at it and try to read it before we end the show. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He writes the No Comment blog for harpers.com. And now I would like to welcome Kate Shepherd, who is a staff reporter at Mother Jones, where she covers energy, the environment, and health. Hi, Kate. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I understand you're at, what is it, the Environmental Journalist Association get together?
Society of Environmental Journalists, yep.
Okay.
We're meeting in Lubbock, Texas.
Oh, interesting. Lubbock, Texas, where there's a lot of Keystone activity going on. So what are journalists, environmental journalists, saying about the energy policy section of the debate, where President Obama and Mitt Romney were basically trying to out each other in who could drill more?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a contest of who loves oil, gas, and coal more, or Mr. Oil, Gas, and Coal, if you prefer. I mean, like, that's the takeaway from a lot of people here is, you know, that the whole conversation has devolved into, you know, who can produce more, you know, energy from fossil fuels here in the U.S. faster. I think a lot of people were disappointed that there was no discussion of environmental consequences or environment period in the debate. Candy Crowley said that she had a climate question, quote, for those climate people. I think a lot of us don't really see climate and environment as a special interest. I think we think it's a pretty important and central question that should be posed to people who are, you know, trying to become our next president.
And how do you explain the lack of coverage in terms of linking energy policies and climate change? And are people at this gathering talking about this?
I mean, I think overall there is a sense among politicians that talking about climate change is not a winning issue for them and that it's not something that people care about. I think that's actually not true. I think there are a lot of people who do care about it, and the people who maybe don't list it as their number one issue aren't going to be alienated by you talking about it. But I mean, we've seen Mitt Romney run away from his positions that he had as governor about climate change and to outright questioning whether, you know, it's a real issue. And I think people are disappointed that it hasn't been talked about more in the campaign. And even if it's not, you know, the number one issue right now, obviously the economy and jobs are still the number one issue for everyone. I think those are very much related to our sort of challenge that we face on environment and energy and sustainability long term. the debate really focused on the entry point in the energy conversation, and the debate was about gas prices, and you know, that is an economic issue for people here in the U.S., and people do care about that. But it really should have been used to get at the sort of bigger questions about, you know, what are we doing long-term rather than what are we going to do short-term to bring down gas prices. And I think that's where we missed an opportunity to ask better questions in the debate, and a candidate just, you know, didn't get a chance to elaborate on what their long-term goal and plan really is.
And Scott, what are your thoughts on this? What role do you think the media should play in really linking energy policies and climate change?
Well, I think this points to one of the weaknesses of presidential debates, because I think as we come down to the last couple of weeks before the election, both campaigns are heavily focused on a tiny group of undecided voters in a small list of states, and they want to frame every single issue in a way that gives them advantage in appealing to that group. And so I think this is just a perfect example of how that works against any sort of satisfying a policy discussion, because in this case it was all about who's going to get you cheaper gas at the gas pump.
Right.
Not at all about satisfying long-term energy concerns that the country has. And I think, you know, we're only going to get a meaningful discussion of those things in a setting that's removed from the elections, where politicians can pull back from these sort of immediate electoral political concerns and reflect more about the future of the country. But I agree absolutely that this, you know, debate was terribly disappointing in that aspect of it. It really went nowhere.
And Kate, we've got a new study from George Mason University and Yale's Project on Climate Change showing that Americans' belief in the reality of global warming is on the rise, actually. 57% in January 2010, 70% in September 2012. So as an environmental reporter, if you've got a media that really isn't linking these questions, how do you and the environmental journalists you are with today, how do you get these stories out and you know, get the politicians to really talk about these important issues?
Well, I mean, I think the reason that we're seeing people's interest in the issues and the level to which they believe it's happening and actually care about it rise, because I think it's pretty self-evident to people. You know, we had hottest summer on record. You had extreme weather all over the country. I mean, people really don't need to be, you know, they don't really need to have it explained to them. They're seeing things that seem amiss to them, and they care about those things because they're personal to their own lives. I think that the candidates aren't talking about it because they still don't think it is a winning issue. I think the solution is that, you know, as a writer and a reporter, that I tell these stories about how what's happening and how it's affecting people's lives and why people care about it, that ideally would move the ball forward and make it an issue that people are talking about and forced to talk about in the debates. I mean, in general, politicians don't respond unless they feel like they're is a consequence for not talking about it. And so unless they feel like they could pay a price for not talking about climate change and talking about our long-term energy plan, they won't talk about it. And so it's sort of about raising the awareness and getting people to press on their leaders to do more.
Well, we've got a few more calls in just a few more minutes. So let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, I wanted to thank everybody there who's doing the job they're doing, particularly the Mother Jones reporter. Of course, everybody's doing a great job, but I want to thank Mother Jones vicariously through her rep there for outing Mitt with the 47% remark. My question, can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is, it seems to me that every Republican administration, at least since Reagan's, has left the country far worse off financially than it was when they took office, by and large, as opposed to certainly the Clinton administration that left us with a substantial surplus. Whether or not it was completely their responsibility, that's still what the statistics are. I don't understand why Barack is so polite in the face of, you know, relentless, vicious attacks on his government creates jobs theory, which obviously is not really his theory, with Romney. I would have rubbed his face much harder in the 47% remark. I think being one of the 47%, I kind of want that to happen. And secondly, I would point out that the trickle-down support private enterprise theory has never worked. All that supports are the people who leave the country with their tax-free income, and invest elsewhere. Thank you. It's a long question, I know, but it frustrates me that the Democrats seem to defend politeness.
Yeah, well, we've been hearing this for like the last 12 years, I think. But thank you for calling. Scott, were you able to hear Robert?
I could make that out. I mean, I think this issue did surface in the last debate a little bit. Remember, one of the questioners asked Mitt Romney to differentiate himself from George W. Bush. And, you know, this is that issue, because I think there's a wide recognition in the country that conditions deteriorated quite dramatically in the Bush presidency. You saw Romney squirm and struggle and not really answer the question in any meaningful way. And I think this is really one of the biggest questions that hovers over his candidacy, that is, distinguish yourself from Bush. What are you going to do that's different? And I think also this question of job creation, you heard Romney repeatedly saying the government doesn't create jobs. In fact, he was even talking over Obama when Obama was answering that question, saying it. And then you saw him go out on the campaign hustings the very next day and promise that he was going to follow in the trail of Ronald Reagan by creating 12 million jobs as president. Well, you know, you can't have it both ways. He was effectively contradicting himself.
Yeah, well,
but, you know, I think this is an unchallenged, not effectively challenged meme that the Republicans use.
And we're almost out of time, and we didn't even get to talk about Guantanamo, the trial that's coming up on Monday, and the NDAA and civil liberties issues that aren't getting any attention. But we'll definitely have you back, Scott. What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a piece talking about this latest decision from Guantanamo, in which we have a very, very conservative Republican court that has basically overturned the conviction of Hamdan and found, again, fatal flaws in the statutory basis for the Guantanamo trials. And this is just as the KSM case is getting ready to go to trial.
That's right. And we'll cover that next week. It's a really important case. Thank you so much. Scott Horton, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, and Kate Shepard, staff reporter at Mother Jones, joining us from the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference in Lubbock, Texas. Scott and Kate, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, and thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up on Monday. What can we learn from the next generation of young environmental activists? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with three winners of this year's David Brower Youth Awards, which honors young people for their achievements in environmental and social justice advocacy. Do you know a young person who's inspired you to do more to protect the environment? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What environmental issues concern young people today? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
President Barack Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney have faced off in two debates. Their final matchup comes just 2 weeks before Election Day, as the last undecided voters are making up their minds. Some of those voters are in the coveted swing state of Florida, where the two candidates will meet on Monday to debate foreign policy. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for special coverage of the third presidential debate from NPR News.
And we will be carrying that presidential debate Monday evening at 6 p.m. right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio. Of course, you can always check us out online at kalw.org. Up next at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. At noon, we have 2 hours of Tavis Smiley and the Smiley and West at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say, live from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio.
Within a few seconds, 2 seconds, very heavy black smoke was clearly visible through our car mirrors. Most of the people just jumped out of their cars and rushed running, panicking towards the blast scene.
A huge explosion has devastated a part of Beirut. With the help of people there, we'll bring you the very latest on the situation. And if you are in Lebanon or have been in touch with those in the city, you can reach us through facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. And then a little later in the hour, we're going to listen in on the multiple discussions taking place about Twitter and whether it should ever restrict what people are saying. A neo-Nazi group in Germany has had its tweets blocked. Do you think Twitter made the right decision?